Up next with Michael Tellinger, some startling conclusions about the origins of humankind. That'll be next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Michael Tellinger is a scientist in the very true sense of the word, never shying away from controversial issues and scrutinizing every clue. He's very meticulous, by the way. After a 30-year-long obsession with the origins of humankind and the genetic anomalies of our species, he wrote Slave Species of God. When Johann Hein exposed the mystery of the stone ruins of South Africa to Michael in 2007, they began an irreversible process of research that then led Michael into more startling scientific conclusions and then the completion of two more works, Adam's Calendar and the Temples of African Gods. Here live is Michael Tellinger. Michael, how are you?
Excellent, George. Nice to be talking to you again after quite a while.
It's coming up on 2 years. I can't believe it.
I know. It's amazing how time flies when you're having fun and up and down the mountains looking at ancient stones, you know.
Where are you right now?
I'm in Johannesburg. I'm actually visiting a friend of mine in Johannesburg. I had to come up for some meetings. So I'm out of the mountains where I've moved to about 2 years ago, just before you and I last spoke. I had just moved into the mountains of Mpumalanga, where most of these ancient ruins are concentrated, and I've been doing most of my research there. But at the moment I'm in Johannesburg.
Well, it's incredible, though. Technology is, I mean, there you are there. I just left Los Angeles. I'm now in the Midwest in St. Louis, and we're carrying on this conversation on 540 radio stations, streaming on the Internet. It's just amazing the way this all works.
Well, I'm glad you guys have got all those bases covered, because I wouldn't know where to begin.
All you have to do is do what you do well. We'll do the rest for you.
Excellent.
Tell me about your latest work, Temples of the African Gods, and how does that relate to your previous two works?
Thanks, George. It really is quite a fascinating sequence of events that's unfolding. And I must admit, I'm probably one of the luckiest explorers or scientists in the world right now. When I first released Slave Species of God in 2006, I never realized that work, which deals with the slave species certain scenario. I heard some of the inserts in between waiting to talk to you, talking about how the world is becoming more and more enslaved, mm-hmm. and how people have just really become clones and drones for the Illuminati and so forth. And it's just amazing to see how my first book, Slave Species of God, how that is becoming more and more true and accurate as time goes by. And that information and that work then led to the discovering of or meeting Johann Heine, who came to one of my talks and presentations on the slave species. And he said to me, listen, I've got to show you some stuff that I've been photographing for the past 20 years. And he started showing me these incredible aerial photographs of these circular stone structures along the mountaintops of southern Africa. And it just blew my mind. And I instinctively knew that somehow those structures were linked to these early, very, very early civilizations of Homo sapiens on Earth. And very shortly after that, Johann then showed me what he discovered. He didn't know its significance was what we now call Adam's Calendar. Now, we now know that it is probably the oldest man-made structure on Earth. It's a beautiful mm-hmm. monolithic calendar. And then when we realize that the calendar, which is incidentally still accurate today, it still works accurately.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, it's ridiculous. It's just spectacular. And I think once the world realizes what there is here, it suddenly makes Stonehenge and the pyramids are impressive, but just the sheer find of this calendar site at this point in time, I think it's going to cause us a stampede. George, I must tell you, when I take people to Adam's Calendar, it changes their lives. You can see their lives have changed. It is quite dramatic.
It hits them. It finally hits them that there's something more than they've ever been taught before, Michael.
Exactly. And that's, it's a very dangerous situation because you're not quite sure what to tell people. So I no longer just take any kind of tourists there. I only do what I call now you know, specialized tours of people that are broad-minded, that are spiritually awake, that are consciously connected, and so forth. And we take those people there who want to know, they're hungry for more information, and you can just throw anything at them, and they are okay with it. Otherwise, you know, if you get a bunch of tourists and, you know, come there and say, well, when I see those big rocks, you know, it doesn't quite work, you know.
How many other explorers over time have shown an interest in these stone ruins?
That's a very interesting story. I'm gonna come back to that in a minute if I can.
Just to finish how these
discoveries link to my work, my first book. It's just really a continuation, and it basically what it does. It for the first time uncovers this vanished civilization, vast, very, very vast vanished civilization that lived at the southernmost tip of Africa, of South Africa and Zimbabwe mostly, that were mining gold. It is the civilization that many, many hundreds, if not thousands of authors have written about for decades upon decades, including Zachariah Sitchin, the brilliant Zachariah Sitchin, and many others. But no one has ever had the physical proof and evidence to substantiate all those writings. And this is for the first time, our discoveries for the first time really substantiate and provide the physical evidence for all the work that has been done by so many brilliant people in the past. And that's what I find absolutely extremely exciting, and I feel very fortunate that I'm, you know, involved in this process. And really it's my work and Jan Heiner's discoveries over the last 20 years that have now finally reached the world. And thanks to people like you that we're getting the message across.
Well, it's exciting, and as you know, Zachariah Sitchin believes that the Anunnaki settled through Iraq, perhaps in part of that region in South Africa as well, to mine for gold, just like you've said.
Yeah, that's it. And that's it. So to come back to your next question, George, is how many people have shown interest in these ruins? That in itself is a fascinating story, which the world does not know.
All right, let's find out. Go ahead.
The fascination with the ruins, the vanished civilizations in South Africa, goes back to the late 1800s already, with the first Portuguese settlers that came around the Cape of Storms, or the Cape of Good Hope, as it's called, the southern tip of Africa. And they started settling and exploring the inner land, and they were known as the degradados, the sort of great unwashed. They would take them out of prison and send them out to explore the, you know, give them an option. Do you want to be a prisoner or do you want to be an explorer kind of thing? And if they didn't come back, nobody lost any sleep. But fortunately, there's one particular guy called Antonio Fernandez in 1510 already, who went and explored from the Mozambican side the inner lands of Africa, southern Africa. And he came back with fascinating stories of ancient ruins and giant stone walls that were completely ruined and overgrown. Nobody was living in it. The people that lived close by, the indigenous people, the native people, didn't know who built those ruins or who built those structures. And in fact, he's got it on record saying that when he asked the people that lived nearby, incidentally, those people that he met were called the Karanga or the Makaranga people, which means children of the sun. All right, now, and that already brings in a huge mystery, because there weren't supposed to be sun-worshipping cultures in southern Africa at that stage. That was all assigned to the northern hemisphere, to Egypt and, you know, those ancient civilizations. So suddenly he comes across the children of the sun, who didn't know where their name really came from and didn't know who built these ancient ruins. And he's got it on record when they said that it must have been done by the devil, because man cannot build such structures. And then by 1891, in the mid-1800s, there were a number of explorers that came through southern Africa studying these ruins. The one that sticks out for me is the brilliant Theodore Bent. He's a British archaeologist that mm-hmm. did a lot of work. He did a lot of work in the Near East, the Middle East, and in Egypt. And then he came down south, and he spent a number of years here traveling through South Africa and Zimbabwe. He was the first guy to really excavate Great Zimbabwe, which we now know from a lot of research that it probably was Enki's headquarters and his head office. And it's part of this ancient civilizations and all these ancient stone structures. It was the mine manager's house. When you travel, I don't know what your mine fields look like in the United States, but in South Africa, the mining towns are normally these small little towns with the people living in the houses around the mine, and the mine manager always lives in a big house on the hill. And nothing has changed. Enki had the big house on the hill. That's pretty much what it comes down to, yeah?
And what time period do you think this might have been, Michael? Because Sitchin, I think, writes 400,000 years ago. Would you echo that? Or that seems like you would, okay.
Well, there are actually two time periods here, George. The first time period is the arrival of the Anunnaki 400,000 years ago. And then there's the actual settlement of the Southern African mine fields, and then starting the cloning process of the new species, the primitive species, the Lulu Amelu and the primitive worker. And it seems to me from current research that we're looking at about 285,000 years when this primitive species was first cloned, the Homo sapiens. And that would also echo the findings of genetic engineering when the first Homo sapiens appeared on Earth around 300,000 years ago.
Truly, it is probably one of the greatest stories of mankind.
It truly is. And it really, you know, what it does for me, it gives me a great sense of understanding. And it's when you start to understand this thing, which I call the great human puzzle, once the pieces of the puzzle start to fit in and you start to see the picture emerge out of this murky, you know, historic, murky sequence of events, it just becomes so exciting when you can place yourself in this great story and start to get a sense and understanding who you are and where you belong and where you come from and why this world is so confusing today.
Has anybody else, along with you and the people that you've just mentioned, really seen the true importance? Do they truly understand what these stone ruins really mean?
Yeah, that is the saddest part of our work at the moment. I must tell you that in South Africa, there is from the authorities side and from the established academia, there is a huge move to discredit what we are doing. They're just not getting it. They just don't get it.
Why are they trying to do that? For political reasons?
Yeah, I guess there's a very strong political motive here. You know, we've gone from apartheid to the opposite situation, where there's a very strong group of black elite politicians who have just taken control. And this is not a racist accusation. This is just, you know, this is a fact. So we've gone from a white extremist to a black extremist situation. I don't want to get too involved in the politics because it's not as bad as it sounds, but it is bad enough to affect people like me and the work that we're doing.
Well, we know, for example, Michael, that good researchers like Zahi Hawass will not listen to any other alternative story about the pyramids of Egypt. When you tell him the possibilities are extraterrestrials helped them or they had high technology, he won't listen to it. And he's very close-minded when it comes to that. I suspect that they're doing the same thing in South Africa.
Yeah, you see, there's a very strong sense of Bantu entitlement at the moment. And I'd like to make that my last political statement because already I'm not well liked and I don't want to make it any worse. But what I'm sad about is that we're presenting the indigenous people of Southern Africa with the greatest story that anyone could ever present them with. To say that this is where the first humans on Earth emerged, and everyone else on Earth is a direct derivative of this first great civilization that lived here. The Egyptians, the Sumerians, the Mayans, the Olmecs, that every civilization originates here. And we see that in the symbols, we see that in the cultures, in the agriculture, we see it in everything we see. The original settlements were here in South Africa and Zimbabwe. And that's a fantastic story to share with the world, that the first civilization on Earth were African.
Was the Garden of Eden there in that region?
That's a good question, and I think it probably has two answers. I think a portion of the Garden of Eden was here, because what we now know as well, George, is the reason why Adam's calendar is so extremely important and why there is so much energy at the calendar site itself. Remember, it's right on the edge of a cliff. It looks out over what's known as the Barberton Valley, the Barberton Impact Crater, where the richest gold mine on Earth still is today, Sheba Gold Mine. You know, Queen of Sheba, Sheba Gold Mine. Maybe they knew something we don't when they called it Sheba Gold Mine. The reason I say that there was probably a Garden of Eden here and in Mesopotamia is because it is at Adam's calendar that they cloned, they actually inserted the first fertilized eggs of this new species, Homo sapien, into the first Anunnaki females to carry the new beings. And be their surrogate mothers. And we read that in the Sumerian tablets, that Zechariah Sitchin speaks about, the first seven Anunnaki birth goddesses or birth mothers. And then we hear an echo of that in Hinduism, the seven birth goddesses and so forth. And then you also, in modern genetics, you hear the seven, you know, seven something of Eve. What are they called again? Seven daughters of Eve.
Seven
and
daughters.
So forth, yeah. And it seems that Adam's calendar is where they performed that first ritual and the actual insemination.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, and that is why Adam's calendar is such an important site, and there's so much energy there. Then when people that have got strong psychic abilities come in there, they go absolutely crazy and they start telling you things that they've never imagined they'd be telling you. And I must tell you that I've learned probably more from psychics and psychic revelations going to Adam's calendar than I've learned from scientific research. And strangely enough, all the psychic predictions or that I'm told eventually tie up with what we find with scientific research afterwards.
Explain the calendar a little bit more for us. Kind of paint us a picture of it.
Okay. It's right on the edge of a cliff. It sits pretty much on 31 degrees east longitudinal line, which is perfectly in line with Great Zimbabwe, the main site of Great Zimbabwe, and the Great Pyramid of Giza, 31 degrees east.
Mm-hmm.
Incidentally, the numeric value for the biblical Elohim is original numeric value is 31. Remember that Hebrew and the old classic languages were based on a numeric system. Each letter had a value, and they didn't just make up words like we make slang words today. You know, that's why our language doesn't have any power or any energy. The original languages were structured around words and the power and the value in the word. So every word had a numeric value, and the word Elohim, that value was 31. Maybe they were trying to tell us something once again. Yeah.
Maybe.
And now,
when you see it's up there on the cliffs, how big is it?
It was originally a circular structure. It's, I have a complete memory block, but it is probably, about 20 meters across.
Oh, it's huge then.
It's reasonably large. Yeah, the original circular structure, and then you have right in the center you have the two main monoliths. For people who want to look at this, incidentally, they can just go to our foundation's website, which is makomati.org. That's makomati.org.
Sure we get a link up there at Coast to Coast for you, Michael.
At least your listeners have a very good look at it to see how it's just so beautiful. It moves me physically every time I look at that picture. I've seen it a million times, and every time I look at it, it still moves me. Anyway, so in the middle, you got these two large monoliths, calendar stones. The one stone is actually the calendar stone itself. And the other stone, which is on the western side, is the stone that casts the shadow on the calendar stone, which allows us to tell every day of the year.
Michael, we're going to take this quick break and come right back and talk more about this. We'll be back. And tonight we're with scientist and researcher Michael Tellinger. Michael, let's get back to the Adams calendar and the stone ruins, and you were describing how they look like. We've got that link for you up already so people can take a look at this. But this is incredible. What was the calendar's intent? What was it supposed to be up there for?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, I think it was originally like a very significant ceremonial site established or built for the arrival of the Anunnaki here in southern Africa, and Enki establishing his great city, this extensively large, the largest stone city or settlement ever built on planet Earth. And when you start looking at it from satellite photographs, it truly takes your breath away for the size of it and the extent of it. And I think Adam's calendar was the flagship and the centerpiece of this settlement here in southern Africa in the middle of the first gold mines on planet Earth. And not only that, it was also, well, that's why, because of its importance and its significance, this is where they then cloned and did the first the actual insemination or the fertilization of the Anunnaki females and started the birthing process of this new species called Homo sapien.
The remarkable, remarkable. Yeah. I want you to weave a story for us, Michael. Some of it may be based on, I think, your gut feelings, your instincts. But give us the position from the moment the Anunnaki came to this planet. What do you think happened? I mean, how did they probably, I guess through their equipment and their technology, they knew that this planet was capable of having life. Until they got here, they probably didn't know what was here.
Yeah.
But give me, paint us a picture on what you think happened.
Well, look, I know that your listeners are very open-minded and are seeking more and more information. So I'm going to share something with you that I normally wouldn't share with people.
All right.
I went for a channeling recently. It was my first channeling ever. And I had a long chat with Enki himself. Now, I know a lot of people will say, yeah, I don't know, you don't quite know who you know, who's coming through and actually giving you the information and so forth. But it was, the information was so consistent with our discoveries and shone a light on much of the things we've been discovering and explained a lot of things that previously weren't, I was a little gray on. And it's very interesting. So the story is pretty much like Zachariah Sitchin sketches and a few other authors have sketched in the past, is that the Anunnaki arrived here 400,000-odd years ago seeking gold. At that stage, they needed the gold for very simple reasons, for climatic problems on their own planet. It was only much later that they discovered the monatomic principles or properties of gold. Mm-hmm. And only then did they started using gold as a source of energy. They didn't know it when they first arrived and started mining the gold. So it's only much later, and I believe that real explosion in knowledge and technology happened after the flood of about 13,000 years ago, the biblical flood, but now I'm jumping a bit. So they came here, they're looking for gold. They found some gold in the Near East. They started mining that. And it wasn't enough.
They were doing that themselves at that point, right?
That's right. They were doing that themselves. And it seems that also they were getting it from sea sand under the water. And from quartzite that's been broken up in sea sand, and they were getting gold out of that. And it wasn't enough. And then Enki took it upon himself. I believe it was Enki, possibly with the help of a few others. They scanned the planet Earth. They flew all over the place looking for more denser and higher deposits of gold, and they found it in southern Africa.
They sure did.
Yeah, they sure did. And then shortly after that, they moved the whole mining operation here to the south. Enki established himself a fortress, his headquarters, which is Great Zimbabwe Ruins. And when your listeners go onto our website, they should also see. I'm not sure if I loaded the aerial picture of Great Zimbabwe, but when you look at the aerial photographs of the stone circular structures and you see a picture of Great Zimbabwe from the air, you instantly see it's the same, exactly the same civilization, the same architects, the same group of people, except Great Zimbabwe is a lot bigger. It's the, as I mentioned earlier, it's the mine manager's house. And so he established his fortress there, and they carried on mining. And then they realized that they weren't getting enough gold. They needed help because there were, 300 odd of them or something like that, maybe
something
600
like that.
At 600 at the most. That's what some of the scholars have come up with, those numbers. And that's just, if you think about gold mining processes, 600 people or 300 people is not going to get you a lot of gold out of the ground.
No. They were loading it onto their craft, right, and then taking off again, back and forth.
Taking it off the planet, yeah.
All right.
And this is where it gets really interesting. When we get back to this giant settlement down here, the gold mining settlement, all the paths and the roadways that we've got here. But let's come back to that later. And so then they started mining. They were on their own. They needed help. And that's when they decided, look, we need help. We need to clone some sort of a robot or a species that is, not too advanced or intelligent to question us or argue with us. We need somebody that will just take instructions, be smart enough to understand instructions, operate some tools, and help us get the gold out of the ground. And I can tell you one thing. I've done a lot of geological research in the last 6 months, and it is not easy to find gold. Okay, I can now say that from personal experience.
Yeah.
Personal attempts to find gold in ore on the surface, and I've analyzed over probably 1,000 rocks and 1,000 sediments and things like that, geological structures. It is not easy to find gold. So when they found the mother lode under the ground here in South Africa, they realized this is where they've got to go en masse and start doing it in big numbers. And that's exactly what happened. They then messed around for a while, planned, did some genetic experiments between themselves and between various other creatures.
And I bet in some cases, Michael, they probably failed miserably and made some incredibly horrible creatures.
Exactly. I mean, you've seen many movies and many stories that have been written about cross-pollinating different species and coming up with these horrible hybrid creatures. Well,
yes.
Those are probably very, very accurate. And my guess is that it's probably happening today. Just we don't know about it. It's probably, assigned to some black ops secret government project where they're cloning, breeding people with other creatures and seeing what they can come up with. And, believe me, it's probably happening.
Well, that so-called mythical creature Pan, who has the human body and torso, but he's got the goat legs or the sheep legs on the bottom with his cloven hoofs.
Yeah.
Maybe they made him,
Well, exactly. I mean, and according to some of the translations of the Sumerian tablets, that's exactly what they say, that they created these creatures. They crossed DNA of ape-like creatures, the Australopithecus, the Homo erectus. They crossed their DNA, and they found, they created horrible creatures that just obviously were completely useless in an intelligent kind of productive environment, or relatively productive environment of work and getting gold out of the ground.
When they finally honed in on us and created us in the image we are now, were we in their image?
That's what it seems like. It definitely seems like it. It was in their image. However, the Anunnaki are described to be tall and blue-eyed and blonde. The creature or the Homo sapiens they created might have been in their image, in the sort of general physical anthropomorphic shape, and had a smooth skin like they did, but it was a darker skin and a reddish skin. They call it red, like the soil of the color of the African soil. And I must tell you, I mean, I'm sure you got the same color in the United States, but I've just come down from a mountain near the border of Botswana where I went to investigate another section of this lost civilization, and it's all the same. I'm just finding all the same direct links, the same tools they were making, the same stone they were using. But when I was coming down the mountain, there was this disturbed soil, and the red color of that soil was just so striking and so rich that phrase from the Sumerian tablets just came to me loud and clear. When Enki says, "I've made him in my image, in my liking, my image," and his color, the skin, of we've created the creature, and his His hair was short and curly, and his skin was the color, the reddish of the color of the African soil. And when I saw that color, it just came shouting back at me. And I remembered that whole thing, yeah.
Now, did they jumpstart the age of the workers, or did they have to wait 20 years before it became somewhat of an adult, and then they put the creature to work?
Yeah, that's, again, you see, these are the things that once you start exploring these ruins and you realize that we're dealing with this first civilization on Earth, we're dealing with the lost city of Enki. This is it. We're right in the middle of it.
Oh, my God.
The vanished, the mysterious lost city of Enki, what everyone's been looking for decades and possibly millennia, right? Now, we're right in the middle of it, and then you start thinking about the pragmatic and the physical processes that had to happen here. Okay, so now you've got to start cloning and creating this new species to help you work in the mines. Okay, well, how do you go about this? First of all, as we know, they bred them through their breeding surrogate mothers, and they kept popping them out. But now, that's not a very clever thing to do, is it? Because you've got to bring up...
It's slow.
It's a very slow process. You got to first bring up the babies from screaming, changing their nappies, and through the terrible twos and the horrible fours, and eventually when they get to the age of 16, you say, okay, well, now you got to leave your mother. You got to go work, be a slave in the mines.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not exactly the kind of situation you want. You don't want attachment by this new species to any kind of mother figure. And what struck me is that they must have had cloning tanks down here and actually cloned this new species into an adult stage. And that's exactly what we found. We found some of these stone ruins are of a very specific shape. And they like hexagonal, and I'm sure that you already, when you hear the word hexagonal, alarm bells start ringing, because the hexagon is a very powerful structure,
yes,
and a shape for the flow of energy, right?
Exactly, exactly.
So when you see these hexagonal kind of stone ruins that are not very big, they're probably about 2.5-3 meters across, if that. And mm-hmm. And they clustered together like a honeycomb. And it's spectacular. You go, what the hell is this for?
No, they could have had hundreds, if not thousands, of these cloning tubes, right?
Exactly. And that's exactly what they had, George. There are hundreds and thousands of these little hexagonal chambers clustered together like honeycombs. And like a honeycomb. And if you think about it, you know, how do bees breed and ants and all that? Yeah, you're looking like an ant's nest or a bee's nest where the little babies come out of, where the bees come out of.
And in this case, they may have come out full-sized, maybe.
Full-sized. In fact, that's what I asked in my channeling. I said, you know, how long did it take to breed or to clone the workers from start to an adult size where they could come out and be immediately productive in the gold mines? And the answer was the normal full term. So we're looking at 9 months to clone from inception to fully cloned human being.
That's amazing. Now, why did they abandon the planet? Something happened.
Yeah, this is the big mystery here. And I tell you, the biggest mystery is not the fact that we have now found this giant city that is that is just so huge it boggles the mind. It makes Los Angeles and Johannesburg and London look like a joke.
Oh, my God. It's that big?
Oh, much, much larger. Much, much, much larger. I'm talking about 10,000 square kilometers per city. Maybe we should just quickly go over the size of this, George.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Let's do that, because we're going to spend another hour next hour talking about this, Michael. And then in the last hour, we're going to take phone calls. So go ahead, explain that.
Excellent. So I'm going to just take your listeners on a little journey. Let's quickly start with the estimates in the past throughout history, how people have sort of come to know about these ruins and then estimated how many they were.
Okay.
Well, the brilliant Theodore Bent, who I mentioned earlier, who was the first guy to excavate Great Zimbabwe, in 1891, he estimated that there were about 4,000 of these stone structures. Now, remember, he was on foot. He was tracking through what was then a very dangerous part of the world. There were lions everywhere and wild animals. It was not an easy place to explore in those days because you're always possible food for some creature somewhere. And then by 1974, there was a chap called Roger Summers who wrote about, I think, three or four books on the ruins of southern Africa. And he did a beautiful calculation, and he, at that stage, calculated that there were about 20,000 of these stone ruins in southern Africa. Now, already, 20,000 is a large number. Because remember, currently, our current history books tell us that southern Africa, until about 1,000 years ago, was extremely sparsely populated. There were only a few thousand people living here, and they were mostly hunter-gatherers.
Hmm.
Now, suddenly we get someone tells us there are 20,000 stone ruins, large circular stone structures. It already doesn't compute.
No, it doesn't. Something happened.
Something happened. And then Jan Heine started photographing this about 20 years ago and realizing that there are many more than just 20,000 of these. I got involved with Jan in 2007, and we started really exploring this with great energy and haven't stopped. By about a year ago, I estimated there were at least 100,000 of these ruins. I made a phone call to the ex-head of archaeology at Wits University, Professor Revel Mason. And when I asked him, Revel, you've been studying these ruins for a long time. How many do you think there were? And he just off the bat said, oh, there's at least 100,000 of these. And I went, that's fantastic, because that's exactly how many I think there are.
Sure.
There must be at least 100,000 of these ruins. And then I said to him, but that tells us that there must have been at least probably, you know, 1 million or 2 million or 10 million people living here. And he went, oh, well, then that can't be 100,000. And you see what happens there is that our academics have They try and force the evidence into their theory instead of taking the evidence and formulating a new theory based on your evidence.
Exactly.
Just like the guys in CSI do. I mean, the guys in CSI wouldn't get anywhere if they had a theory and trying to fit the evidence into their theory.
Have any other explorers in mass just gone down to that area to do some work? It's amazing that they've just left it. It's just there, huh?
No, the only two people that are doing any work on this is Jan Heine and myself, as incredible as it sounds. And I know it may come across as a bit arrogant, but that's what it is.
Why? Do you have helpers? You must.
No, we don't.
You've discovered one of the greatest finds of all mankind, and it's just the two of you. That's incredible. Michael, we're already at the top of the hour. We're going to come back with more. I want to get into the Anunnaki. I want to get your take on why you think they left. Then we'll talk more about the ruins on Coast to Coast AM. Michael, I'm very spiritual. Some of the things we'll be talking about tonight, some may think that we're conflicting with the Bible. I don't think it does. I think the Bible truly is a remarkable, remarkable book, and that it's subject to interpretation. It's subject to trying to decipher what it meant at that particular time. With that being said, let's talk about the flood during Noah's era that you mentioned some time ago. You know, the Bible would say it was God's way of cleansing the planet, getting rid of evil. And, you know, he saved Noah and a small group of people and some animals. Yep. I am wondering if Noah was tipped off by, let's say, the Anunnaki, who took off for some reason, and was the flood caused, for example, by an asteroid that hit the planet and caused a massive tsunami, for example. What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. The flood, the flood, which is now generally accepted by meteorologists and geologists and historians and so forth, seem to have happened around 13,000 years ago, give or take a few hundred years either way. But whatever is said, there was a huge geophysical event that happened at that stage. It may also link up with the work of Paul LaViolette and the giant pressure waves that come from the center of the galaxy and all these things. But so there's a numerous scientific and cosmological events that could have contributed to this event. But I think primarily it would have been probably caused by the coming into very close proximity of planet Earth of a very large celestial body, whether it was another planet like the Sumerian Nibiru, or the Anunnaki's Nibiru, or a giant comet, or something like that. But it definitely caused huge geophysical disturbances, which, according to the Sumerian tablets, caused the entire Antarctic ice sheet to slip into the ocean. And that was the real main cause for the giant wave or the flood that destroyed the planet. And that is a huge, huge realization, because this entire discovery of ours here in South Africa shows evidence of such a flood. And that is the most exciting link that we've made, that and why this ancient, this very vast ancient civilization just vanished out of sight. I believe that it's because of the flood 13,000 years ago, and we can see the sediment on the ruins, meters and meters, sometimes 20, maybe even 30 meters of sediment that has been settled, but deposited on these ancient cities down here. We can also see it, especially in the valley below Adam's calendar, where we incidentally also have pyramids. I believe they're the first pyramids ever built on Earth, Enki's pyramids. Mm-hmm. There are three pyramids, two large ones and one smaller one, just like in the pyramids in Giza. And they are directly aligned with the rise of Orion's Belt. Surprise, surprise.
Yeah, exactly.
So it starts to really link up everything we see down here, the structures, the sphinxes, the Horus stones that we found, the pyramids that we found, all linked to Adam's calendar, are also linked to all the symbols that we find much later in northern civilizations. But all of this was destroyed, I believe, by the flood some 13,000 years ago, which the Anunnaki knew about. They knew the flood was going to happen because they realized that this giant celestial body was going to cause geophysical disturbances. At that stage, the Sumerian tablets tell us they were going to allow the flood to basically destroy the planet because the population of humans has just grown out of control, and they needed to pretty much wipe them out, allow the flood to do its natural thing. But as you said, it seems like Enki was the creator of this whole new species, Homo sapien. He told one or two of the characters down here how to survive, gave them instructions how to build a submersible boat, because you couldn't just have a boat. It would have to be submersible. And they survived, and they went, and he gave them instructions how to collect the essence of the animals and the seeds and the plants, essence of the plants and the animals, not the animals themselves. I mean, you can very quickly figure out that it's not going to be possible to bring animals two by two onto a boat, you know. So clearly Enki realized that there was this huge catastrophe looming, and right. he wanted to create some sort of a vault of seeds and DNA to repopulate the planet after
the
disaster.
Which is what they're doing now.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Just, we were talking before the break, we were talking about the numbers of these ruins.
Yeah.
And we didn't quite get to the real aha moment. Because once I realized that there were about 100,000 of these, and then suddenly, you know, a few months later, my estimate went up to 200,000. Before I published and released Temples of the African Gods, incidentally, that book will be in the United States and the UK in May this year, and next month. It'll be okay. Available next month.
So we're ahead of the game here, aren't we?
Yeah. Once I realized, before I went to print on the book, I thought, you know, I can't just thumb suck a number, because that's what everybody else has been doing. And I want to be slightly more scientific about it. And with the benefit of aerial photography and satellite photography, you can do a lot more, be a lot more specific and accurate. And remember that I've been walking these mountains and these ruins for a number of years now. So it's only once you've been at the ruins on ground level and you know what they look like on the ground, and then you look at the satellite photographs and you see what that area looks like from satellite,
mm-hmm.
then you can suddenly compute, okay, that's what it looks like from the satellite pictures. Now you can start extrapolating that and looking at other areas and seeing where you see the same formations.
Precisely.
And that's when suddenly the lights went on for me, and I discovered what I now call the three lost ancient cities. One is in the area that I live in, which is near Waterfallbuffen in Mpumalanga. That's where it really is thick and dense. Then the other one is near Rustenburg, where I actually went to school, which also incorporates the Sun City, the holiday resorts of Sun City, where they play the golf tournament every year.
Sure.
They built the Palace of the Lost City there accidentally on the ancient civilizations. They're not even aware of this.
That's amazing.
There's another lost city there. And then there's the other one, which is incorporates Great Zimbabwe and the large area around it. Now, each one of those cities, those lost, vanished cities, is probably about 10,000 square kilometers. So it's about 100 by 100 kilometers. So they're 60 by 60 miles.
Huge.
So if you compare that to the size of LA or London, it's a lot bigger than any of
them. Yeah. And these were all ancient gold mining sites as well? These three sites?
Okay. Exactly. And then I started counting on Google and on satellite how many of these there are. And I estimate that there are at least 3 million of these stone ruins per lost city.
Let me ask you this, Michael. Regardless, let's just toss out for a moment the Anunnaki theory, which I think is the most plausible. But
yeah.
let's just toss that out. How old are these ruins? What do you think?
Our dating is going back to about 280,000, 300,000 years, around there. The fascinating
Amazing.
Thing is that, George, what we've done, there's so much ground to cover here that it's just like I'm sort of gasping for air trying to know, okay, where should I go next, you know?
God, I mean, it's just incredible.
With the stone tools, remember, we've now uncovered a completely different class and a type of stone tool that is directly linked to these stone structures and these settlements. And they are completely different from any other stone tools. In fact, when I started collecting these tools and showing them to archaeologists, they told me I was stupid, I didn't know what I was doing, and I'm wasting my time. And we've realized now that this is a whole new class of stone tools that has never been recognized before. And we've got them by the thousands.
What do they look like?
They are a very conical kind of stone, a stone that's been shaped into a very conical, like an ice cream cone almost. It's rounded at the top with a slight edge on the one side and then comes down to a point on the other side. And this is just a repetition of this particular stone tool. What they use it for, I have no idea. But what we do know is that they were not carved or chipped. They were molded. And that's what makes them so unique.
Okay. They were molded.
They were molded. Now, a few other anomalies that we have to throw out there is that all these millions of stone ruins were built from the same kind of stone. Okay, they didn't just use any kind of stone that was lying around. It was a very specific stone.
This was stone that was there, or did they bring it in?
No, it was brought from elsewhere. The stone is not necessarily always the bedrock stone where the structures are. It seems to have been brought from other areas in the rivers, in the riverbeds, because all the stones that formed the original structures, we've got to distinguish now. Remember, we're dealing with thousands and 300,000-year period here. So there have been many civilizations that have come since and rebuilt on top of these original structures. And that's what causes the confusion.
Okay.
With archaeologists.
All right.
Okay, that's what confuses a lot of archaeologists. And the poor guys just don't know where to turn because they don't have the broader sort of background of the Anunnaki and the gold mines. So they look at the ruins and they see, okay, well, this was built by the migrating tribes from the north about mm-hmm. 200 or 400 years ago. And that's where it ends, currently.
Okay. No, they need to have a basis of this historical event in order to even move forward. I think, yeah. Or something like that.
Now, the stones are all the same stones, the original structures, and then you see the later civilizations using other stones on top.
Why did they have doorways?
They didn't have doorways, and this is the other anomaly. The original circles did not have any entrances or doorways, and that is written on many archaeological reports from over 100 years ago already. And that was one of the anomalies that has caused a lot of confusion. How do you build a circular stone structure, which is either a dwelling or a place of worship or a place of work or whatever?
With no doorways.
No doorways. And, then in the next breath, our very clever historians say, it must have been built by a small family of 15 to 20 people as they were migrating south. And then you go, which planet do you come from, dude? Have you thought about this?
They probably came from Nibiru.
Yeah. Have you thought about this practically? In one sentence you say, here's this huge structure. It's got 100-meter circumference. There's a lot of complex internal structures, but there's no doorway and no entrance. And then suddenly you realize that each one of these ancient original stone circles was linked by a road or a channel of sort that was walled. These walled roads had run for thousands and thousands of kilometers, linking each and every single one of these original stone circles.
How tall were the walls?
That boggles the mind.
How tall were the walls?
At the moment, the tallest wall we have in the ruins is about 3 meters tall. So it's about 9 feet, 10 feet tall.
All right, that's pretty good size.
Some of them are reasonably tall still, but most of them have been reduced down to, 4 or 5 feet.
There's got to be a reason why these channels, or if that's what they were built. There's got to be some purpose. I don't think it's not to direct people to walk in and out, or maybe it is.
Yeah. Thank you, George. You put your finger right into the most important aspect of this. And this is why our journey of discovery has been such an exciting thing, because, you first look at these aerial photographs and you see, look at all these roads linking these circles together. There are thousands of them, and they all go straight into the circle, but they don't have any entrances. Once again, there are no doors or entrances in or out of these channels or these roads. They run into the circle, and they end either on the outer wall, or if they don't end there, they go into the inner circle, and they end at the wall of one of the internal structures. Now, each and every one of these stone circles is unique. It is a completely unique structure. It's almost as if it's a fingerprint of some sort of flow of energy or something. Now, when you start looking at the stones, the kind of stone that was used to construct these ruins, and you realize that they ring like bells, suddenly the alarm bells start to ring. And if you know anything about sound frequency...
Yep, there's some resonance there, right?
Exactly. Now we're dealing with circular structures built of stones. They're known as hornfels. They're metamorphosized quartzite. It's about 54% silica dioxide and about 24% aluminium and about 18% iron. And the rest is really insignificant, but it's those three metals that are the most significant component of this.
These things were like an energy plant or something.
Exactly. That's exactly what it is. And it took us how many years to figure this out? When you have these beautiful stones that ring like bells, and they truly, it is spectacular. When you ring one of them and it rings from various frequencies. I recorded these frequencies, and we got the recordings down from about 200 hertz up to about 16,000 hertz. Now, that's very close to the human audible spectrum.
Yeah.
That frequency. But I guess they'll go a lot lower and they'll go a lot higher. We went out for one day, recorded a whole bunch of them, and then went into the studio to analyze it.
Was this energy used to power up their cities?
Correct. Now, this is what we discovered, is that, and this is what I figure, right, is that here we got circular stone structures made of stones that ring like bells, And they also have other interesting properties. This particular rock of silica dioxide, incidentally, also is supposed to give off pockets of electromagnetic energy. This is the work that was done by Dan Burish and his research project. And they found that silica dioxide in specific concentrations gives off what they call these pockets of electromagnetic energy. So now we've got stone circular structures linked by these channels, all made from the same stone, that ring like bells, have incredible audio properties, have high content of silica dioxide, which we know is basically quartz crystal, right, which are very strong energy devices. And they give off pockets of electromagnetic energy. It screams at you that these were energy devices. And how did they generate energy? I believe that they created what we would call a standing wave that went around and around the outside wall. Now, you know that the Ankh, the Egyptian Ankh, was actually an energy-generating frequency device. And once again, for your listeners, the Egyptian Ankh is no longer an Egyptian Ankh. It is now a South African Ankh because we have 200 or 300,000-year-old petroglyphs, beautiful carvings of Ankhs inside radiating circles that are discovered, carved into diorite and andesite, which is the second hardest rock you can find, with incredible signs of erosion on it. So we know that whoever lived down here, these first people, already knew the symbol of the Ankh and its energy frequency and its vibrational frequency potential. And I believe that the Ankh was like the tuning fork or the device that was used to kickstart this circular standing wave sound frequency that went around the walls of these stoned ruins.
Do you know if we could duplicate that today, Michael, what we would be able to do for free energy and everything else?
Well, that's exactly, that's it. You know, I lie awake at night thinking about these things because clearly these guys knew stuff that we have only rediscovered. People like Nikola Tesla probably tapped into that same body of information, and then his information was removed from the planet very quickly. Before him, it was the wonderful John Keeley, who I believe was actually the real great master of the last 120 years, who also discovered the frequency of the power of the sound frequency. And then obviously also Royal Raymond Rife, who found the cure for all disease.
Look what they did to him.
Exactly. You know, so we're all dealing with the three very important figures in recent human history that used sound vibrational frequency for free energy, to cure all disease, for light, for all these kind of things.
Michael, when we come back, I want to ask you if you believe the Anunnaki may still be coming back here. We'll be back. And, of course, next hour we're going to take your phone calls with Michael Tellinger. Just an incredible story, and there's more when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Michael, do you think the Anunnaki, if they were here, they probably, if they're still in existence, they've come back. Do you think they have?
Yeah, again, one of those questions that everybody wants to know and have a definitive answer to. And, you know, the more I look at this and the more I study these ruins, realizing this is the work of the Anunnaki, I believe that there are still some Anunnaki left here. I don't think all of them had left. Whether we're ever going to meet them or find them, that's another question. I'm not sure if any of the people you've interviewed in the past claim they've met some of the Anunnaki. I believe that there's still some Anunnaki left on planet Earth. But by the same token, I believe that they have evolved themselves, just like we've evolved, and it's an inevitable process, and now we know so much more about our DNA and how our DNA responds to this primordial light source from the galactic center, and that it's an unstoppable process of evolution that we just constantly move towards higher consciousness. And I guess the same could be said for the Anunnaki. So while we are evolving, they've been evolving over a long period of time, and it's possible that they might even exist in different physical structures. They may no longer be in a physical form. Maybe they've moved on to a higher energy level, and and be called beings of light or something like that. And I'm suspecting that there could be something like that going on.
What about the planet Nibiru? According to Zachariah Sitchin and his work, it's on a 3,600-year elliptical orbit. So it comes around every 3,600 years. I was with him a few months ago in Los Angeles, where he was given the Lifetime Achievement Award for the Conscious Life Expo. And he said it probably won't be around for at least another 15 to 2,000 years. Do you think it's still out there in the solar system?
Well, absolutely. I believe it's out there. I'm very glad to hear you say that, because that was my calculation as well. Probably about 1,500 years or so before it comes back. However, we've got to be very careful here that, you know, once a planet is out in deep space, in deep orbit, and 3,600 years away from the sun, a very small deviation in its orbit will have a profound effect on what happens when it comes closer to the sun, and vice versa. So every time Nibiru comes, or any planet or asteroid or comet comes around the sun, it will have a slight effect on what happens to it in deep space. And we may not see it in our lifetime, because we're only around for such a short space of time. But when you observe it over a few million years, or a few hundred thousand years, it will have probably a giant deviation from its original path. So that could play a role,
Well, your work has been just fantastic, and it's hard to believe that just you and Johann were the only two that are working on that. You should be given some kind of Nobel Prize for this.
Well, you know, George, it's not. There are others working on the ruins, but unfortunately, they're just looking at it from, you know, a 200 or a 400-year-old history. You know, the most recent settlers, and they scratch around, they found a few pot shards and a few beads and things, and they say, you see, this is evidence of the Sututswana culture, or the evidence of the Pedi culture. And they say, see, it can't be more than 400 years old. And then I very quickly want to remind them that, you know, rule number one in archaeology is that civilizations build on top of each other. And it seems to be the first rule that our friends forget when they leave university. So I get a little irritated when they start doing that, because they just, you know, look what's happening in Rome and in London and in Paris when they're discovering the lost cities under the what we think we know very well, you know, ancient history of these cities that we knew nothing about. So you can imagine how much mystery lies below the sand here in southern Africa of the largest city ever built, Stone City, by Enki himself. And we think that, you know, by scratching around the surface, we're going to get some answers. That's not going to work.
Don't they see the difference between a 300,000 to 400,000-year-old structure and something that was made 300 years ago? Can't they see that?
Well, obviously they don't. And just because I can just imagine your listeners are going, now, well, how do you know that it's 300,000 years old? So I better quickly jump there and explain why we have such evidence.
Right. You can't carbon date stone, so go ahead.
Yeah, exactly. You know, first thing people ask, well, did you do any carbon dating? I say, well, not really, as you say. You can't carbon date stone. So we got to work with every other scientific principle that we can embrace and get some scientific data back from that research. And so we look at all kinds of things. First of all, I've already mentioned the alignment with the rise of Orion, the Orion's belt alignment at Adam's calendar. The fact that we have a Horus stone, which marked the rising of the sun on the spring equinox a long, long time ago. The fact that we found a small little sphinx carved out of stone a few hundred meters north of Adam's calendar, and so forth. The alignment to Orion's belt only starts to make sense when you go way over 100,000 years. Otherwise, it doesn't seem to compute and align. Okay, so we're dealing with something that's at least 100,000 years old, or probably a lot older.
Yeah.
Then we start looking at the erosion on the stones. We're dealing with the two very, very hard stones. We're dealing with dolerite. Dolerite is a very hard stone. It also has very strong acoustic and magnetic properties. And then the other stone that is used in the dolerite, incidentally, is used at Adam's calendar. All the stone at Adam's calendar is dolerite. and it was brought from some distance away to build on the edge of the cliff. It is not part of the bedrock. Okay. Then the erosion on the rocks is a very, very good indicator of its age. These rocks do not erode quickly. And when you see some of the eroded edges where we see breaks on one of the stones at Adam's Calendar, there's at least a centimeter or two of erosion on the broken edge. Now we start dealing in hundreds of thousands of years and not just, you know, hundreds or a few thousand years.
Right. If you didn't know about the story of the Anunnaki, if you didn't know that at all, would you still be saying this is much older than most people are saying?
Absolutely. It's purely just scientific observation. Even if I was oblivious of the Anunnaki, which incidentally most of the archaeologists here are, they just are oblivious. And I had an email received from the head of anthropology at the big university in South Africa a few weeks ago saying that he finds my work preposterous and devoid of any scientific merit. I found that quite interesting because archaeology is not exactly a scientific study. I didn't want to remind him of that, but anyway. What we find is the erosion is a very, very good indicator. And then the other thing is the patina growth. And this is a beautiful, beautiful scientific argument that is very difficult to argue against.
Now, explain that. What is that?
The patina growth, the patina is what you would call the skin of the rock, okay?
Okay.
And when you break a rock, you'll see very quickly the inside of the rock is a darker or a different color from the outside of the rock. And the particular rock that we have here that has been used in the construction of the ruins is, as I mentioned earlier, it's called the Hornfels. Its actual name is Hornfels, named after a German geologist. And when this rock is exposed to outside air and outside elements, it starts to grow this patina, the skin, which is a combination of oxidization, of calcification, of all kinds of chemical processes that on the surface of the rock that are guided by and aided by oxygen and rain and the climatic circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
And this particular patina grows very, very slowly. It grows about 5,000 years from current research available. It grows about 5,000 years for the first microscopic layer to form. Now, we've got beautiful examples of monoliths that are built into these walls that have broken, where we see the growth of the patina back to a 1 or 2 millimeters, which tells us that that rock has been in situ in that stone wall for at least 100,000 years, probably way over 200,000 years, just based on the growth of the patina. And that is a phenomenal discovery and not something you can just shove under the carpet conveniently and say, well, it's just built by the migrating tribes 200 years ago, because that doesn't wash.
Does Zechariah know of your work? You know of his. Does he know of yours?
Of course. I read all Zechariah Sitchin's work. Look, the new book, Temples of the African Gods, is just about to be released in America. And really, only when it is released in America does it really hit the main frame of global attention. So I expect as of May this year, next month, we'll get some real attention on these discoveries. I plan to visit the United States in July, August, to do my first visit to the States and do a number of talks. I hope to, you know, make contact with people and organizations that will help me do this tour.
Will you be in the L.A. area?
I would love to. I must come to L.A. Of course, okay. I must come to L.A.
Yeah, I'll be there then, so let's get together.
Well, what I'd like to do while we've got this platform is to say for those people that are in the media or in the events sort of area who feel they can get involved with my trip to the States to take this message to the American people, please email me and tell me, look, we can help you in this town or this city or this state. And that'll certainly help me a great deal. Remember, I'm a self-published author. I don't have a huge publisher behind me to set this up and organize this for me, so.
Well, maybe we got to change that for you too, Michael.
So
get this in the right hands.
Well, George, I appreciate it. And it, really, if it wasn't for you and the fact that you took a chance on interviewing me when I first released Slave Species of God, we wouldn't be here today. And I probably would not have made the discoveries. It's really people like you that have been played a very important role in the discoveries that Johanna and I have made, because it's kept the flame going, you know. Otherwise, it would have died a long time ago.
Well, it's an incredible flame. It's a flame that needs to stay lit, and you've done a great job doing that, Michael. And it's just, to me, there's nothing more fascinating and exciting than art history, something where we can find out once and for all who are we, why we're here. And let me tell you why I think your work and Sitchin's work happens to be so exciting. Because even though I'm a staunch believer that we were genetically altered, that the Anunnaki came here, it doesn't negate the fact that there is a divine creator who played a part in their existence.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it is important for me to state this, because what I find interesting, I'm getting more and more Christian groups and religious groups that are part of established religion coming to my talks and my presentations, because I never ever denounce the existence of a divine creator or a divine being.
You can't.
In fact, no, you can't do that, exactly. In fact, I just separate and distinguish between God with a big G and then these you know, gods with a small g that came to planet Earth and created a new being and used them for their purposes, and then things all went very, very wrong and belly up. And it's very interesting when you start looking at the knowledge of these people here in Southern Africa and the technology they used for generating energy, vibrational frequency, their knowledge of vibrational frequency, energy for levitating things, for crushing the stone, for separating the gold and the platinum and all the other metals that they were mining, including iron, separating them and smelting them and then using them for whatever they were using them. They had knowledge of vibrational energy, vibrational frequency. Now, we mentioned before the break that it was only recently, 100-odd years ago, that people like John Keely and Nikola Tesla and Royal Rife rediscovered the power of this vibrational frequency, specifically the frequency of sound, and they started applying that in their own fields of science. But that information was very swiftly removed from society, because, you know, the Illuminati do not want us to have that knowledge, because that frees us from the prison, doesn't
there
it?
There was a little frail guy, 120 pounds. His name was Edward Leeds Skolnin, and he came from Eastern Europe, came to the United States, settled in Florida. He constructed by himself a stone block, small little town, basically. It was really, you know, it was like you would consider it a house. And he did it all by himself, moving these stones that were huge. And he said he knew the secrets of the pyramids. I think it had to do with magnetics and resonance and everything else.
Exactly. And what I find interesting as well, when I've taken some open-minded geologists that have sort of, that are not working in the mainframe and have to abide by the geological society's rules, that can allow themselves to think a bit freely, when I take them to the ruins and they see some of the shapes of the stones, they just freak out. They say, this is not possible. These stones do not make any sense. It looks like somebody had molded it into that shape and then, without heating it up, and then let it to set or dry. Because some of these stones in the ruins are, first of all, they don't belong there, and they're a stone that does not belong in that area. And then, secondly, they're very rounded. And then in their rounded shape, they develop these very strange cracks along the surface, which don't make any sense in geological terms. And it's as if somebody knew the secret to manipulate the energy flow through that rock, the vibrational frequency, so that they can soften it like plasticine and or molding clay, and then mold it into a circular or a spherical shape, and then let it dry. And then because they disturb the molecular structure of that particular rock, it then shows these interesting cracking patterns on the outside surface. But these are just some of the anomalies that we're discovering. What I want to bring to your attention as well before we go to the break at the top of the hour is the energy devices that these guys were building, the structures and the shapes of these ruins that once again we rediscovered in the 1930s and 1940s. Some of the, on the Makamati website, there's also a picture of one of the stone structures which was in the 1940s used by the Japanese to design and create what they call the death ray.
That's
I believe they would have borrowed that from Nikola Tesla. And they were designing the weapon with which they were going to smite the Allied armies, right?
They wanted to knock planes out of the sky.
Exactly.
You name it.
And they did that with this device called the death ray. And when you go and look at the schematics and the drawings of the death ray, it was basically a little small dish, like a satellite dish, maybe a meter or two in diameter. And at its heart is what they call a klystron or a magnetron. And the magnetron and the klystron is probably not more than, 6 inches in diameter. And it was that device and the shape of that device that caused the generation of the very high, powerful vibrational frequency with which they then used, that became the death ray. Now,
if you use that today, I bet you could cause an earthquake.
Well, now you really put your finger right into the middle of this, because now we're getting a direct link not only to the ancient civilizations here, but also to the sinking of Atlantis.
Okay, ah. Now,
before the previous break, you mentioned, you picked up immediately that these stone circular structures with all these channels and roads that link them together without any doors or entrances, and sometimes multiple concentric circles, okay, linked to these channels, or these so-called roads, each one is linked, okay?
Mm-hmm.
These were energy devices. There's no question about that. There is no other plausible scientific explanation for it. They certainly were not roads to drive cattle on, which is what our historians would like us to believe. And they weren't dwellings because they had no entrances, okay? So they must have been something else, and that something else were energy devices to drive this huge population of probably 50 to 100 million people that lived here over a 270,000-year period mining gold. They needed energy from somewhere for all this activity. And many of these clustered areas are very specifically energy devices. Now, when you look at the shape of a klystron or a magnetron in the Japanese death ray, it is identical, and I mean identical, to the stone ruins that we have down here, many of the stone ruins, except that the stone ruins are 20 meters in diameter, while the klystron and the magnetron in the death ray were 6 inches in diameter. So you can imagine the immense power generated.
Huge. Stay with us. We're going to take phone calls next hour, Michael, with you on Coast to Coast AM. So, Michael, when the Japanese designed their death ray, and it was exactly like the ruins and the energy cycles that they had during the Anunnaki period, did they luck out or did they know something?
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't really have the answer to that. I guess maybe they did some research and realized that there was ancient knowledge and ancient information available, and they used, I believe Nikola Tesla is the guy that that really brought that to the attention of the world, the knowledge of vibrational frequency. And I think the Japanese probably just used more of Nikola Tesla's work than looking at ancient civilizations. But Tesla is really the guy, I believe, that rediscovered what these early people here in Southern Africa knew, and that is that energy flows out of the planet, out of the surface of planet Earth. In one of the books that I've got of Tesla, in his own handwriting, he says that the Earth rings like a bell. And if you know how to harness that sound energy from the surface of planet Earth, you can convert it into any other form of energy and use it for whatever purpose you need. And
good,
I think,
point.
That's exactly what these early mining, the Anunnaki did here in Southern Africa. They designed this whole giant ancient settlement here as a giant energy grid, with which they used that energy generation for their mining operations, their levitation devices to move the ore around on these channels that linked everything together as well. And also, I believe that it was this design of this Klystron or magnetron design that was such a very, very powerful, incredibly powerful energy-generating device that may have been replicated in Atlantis many, many thousands of years later, and was possibly the downfall or the energy burst that caused the sinking of Atlantis.
Can you imagine with the price of gold, what it is today, how much gold they took out in terms of money value? My, that must have been trillions of dollars, Michael.
I don't think we could calculate it, how much it was worth. You know, George,
astronomical.
It's literally, you know, how long have we been mining gold in sort of living memory? You know, we go back to King Solomon and all the gold that he amassed. Oh, incidentally, I forgot to mention, obviously by now, your listeners would have put two and two together and realized that we're dealing with King Solomon's mines right here in South Africa, right? That's what we're dealing with. There's no question about it.
Let's take some calls. Let's go to Seattle, Washington, west of the Rockies. Terry, get us going. Go ahead, Terry.
Hi, George. Hi, Michael. A couple quick questions on one. Sure. Biblical scripture refers to the streets in heaven being paved with gold. I wonder if you've ever given any thought to that, if there's any connection. I don't know if that would be gold fallout from the atmosphere or whatever. And the other question would be, are there many UFO sightings in that area?
Yeah, thanks for that question. Streets of heaven being paved with gold. I think we got to distinguish between what we have become obsessed with as humans who have been driven to fear by institutionalized religion. Okay, we've been controlled through this thing called fear and, you know, damnation and the moment where you get judgment, whether you've been a good boy or a bad boy, either you know, destined for eternal damnation or eternal bliss. And, you know, personally, I don't believe there's such a thing as heaven. I believe that we're all part of the divine being. We're all one. We're actually all one with the divine being, but we have been we've been taught that we are separate, and the division has been sown among human beings, and that's why there's so much strife and problems on planet Earth, while we actually should realize we're all one. I think the Sumerian tablets often refer to heaven as another planet, as planet Nibiru, and the Anunnaki would have referred to heaven as their planet. So maybe because they took so much gold of this planet, they would have referred to their streets on planet Nibiru being paved with gold. Maybe that's a better description of what they might have been referring, because heaven was probably referred to as the home of the gods with a small g, by the early humans, and not going back to source or reconnecting with a divine being.
And he's asking about UFO reports in the region. What do you think?
UFO reports, plenty. I mean, I personally have photographed three UFOs over and above the ruins where I live. Three UFOs. My friend Michael Fanikak, whose house I'm at right now, he has a phenomenal video clip that he took on which he has at least eight UFOs flying through this one little clip, which is probably about a minute long. And we've identified eight UFOs. They move so fast through the shot that the camera actually only picks it up in two frames. So UFO sightings, there are plenty of all the time. They're also vortexes and active portals that have been identified by, you know, people that are a lot more closely linked to that, picking up that kind of energy. There is one such site close to Rustenburg, which they believe is an active portal with lots of UFO sightings coming and going all the time. Yeah, so that's a lot of that.
All right, let's go to Marietta, California. Francine on the wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast, Francine.
Good evening, Mr. Tellinger, Mr. Norrie. It's an honor to be on tonight. I had a question regarding if you're obviously you're probably aware of the Human Genome Project that's going on, where they've traced humans to seven basic tribes that have come out of Africa. Every single person on the world, they basically traced back to Africa. And what you think about that? Because it really does show that our DNA and our heritage does go back to Africa, and about the fact that we have less chromosomes than many animals, like chickens, and yet we're able to use computers, talk the way we're talking, and it really, I think, is a mystery as to why we're the ape that's talking right now rather than chimpanzees or gorillas.
Yeah.
Good
thanks
question.
Very much.
Go ahead.
Yeah, thanks very much, Francine. That the genetic anomaly is definitely one of the first warning signals that we get that something is not quite right with our species, that we have been manipulated, that, you know, all other primates have 24 pairs of chromosomes, we have 23 pairs of chromosomes. But then when you take the sex chromosome out of it, we actually have 22 pairs of chromosomes, which becomes very interesting. Because the number 22 is a fundamental frequency that seems to govern a lot of interesting things and the flow of energy. First of all, the planet Earth, the number of the work I've been doing with the brilliant Willem de Swart, I'm busy finishing a work with him called The Secret Numbers of God. We should publish that this year still. And Willem has basically decoded the whole universe and everything with a brand new set of geometry that links into sacred geometry. And the reason I'm talking about this is because it links to the genetic thing, and everything is dictated and seems to be explained with the numbers that Willem has decoded. And it tells us that the number 22, which is the number of original chromosomes we have, comes from some sort of a manipulative process that you have to have 22 pairs of chromosomes, and the 23rd was slapped on as a sex chromosome so we can procreate. Then there are 22 fundamental frequencies from which all other frequencies seem to emanate. Around the Greater Giza Plateau, there are 22 pyramids, and so it goes. The 22 over 7 gives you pi, and et cetera. So the number 22 is very interesting. And the genetic anomalies in human DNA is a big warning flag to say something is not quite right with our species, and let's pay attention to that. Yeah, and what was the other part of your question now? I get distracted.
Well, she was just talking about the Genome Project and the fact that why the chimpanzees aren't the ones talking and we were.
Yeah, exactly.
And you answered that.
Yeah, isn't that a great – I think there's a wonderful story where a little grade two boy asks, well, if we evolved out of apes, why are they still apes? it's a lovely little question, and I just it's quite humorous, isn't it?
Oswego, New York, we go. Ed, it's your turn. Go ahead, Ed.
Yes, I was just good morning to both of you. Wondering what kind of transportation did the Anunnaki have, if there's any evidence left, and any carvings around showing how they traveled the whole world or not.
Transportation on this planet, you mean?
Yes, how if they moved around the planet to different parts of the
okay.
other
what
continent.
Do they have? What do they have for people movers, Michael?
The best description comes from the Sumerian tablets. Personally, at this stage, nor myself nor Johan have found any petroglyphs of that would resemble transportation devices. Here, we have found hundreds and hundreds of fascinating petroglyphs, including the very important image of the Ankh carved in a beautifully radiating circle. Which tells us they knew about vibrational frequency and the use of energy and vibration and sound. But transportation devices, that's a tough one. That we haven't got any physical carvings evidence of yet, but the Sumerian tablets tell us about the different devices that they used. It seems that they had three different types of devices, transportation devices. They had terrestrial devices that they used on planet Earth to go from place to place. Then they had another device that they went from Earth to their space station, which was in orbit above planet Earth. And then they had another transportation device that went from the space station to deep space into their planet. So I guess there were probably three devices, which sort of makes sense to me.
Was there any evidence during this time period of any kind of nuclear explosion, some kind of a blast, some kind of a war? Anything there?
Down here at this stage, no. But obviously there's the famous story of Sodom and Gomorrah.
Yeah.
And a lot of evidence there in just south of the sea in Israel, the Sodom and Gomorrah sites where they believe Sodom and Gomorrah were positioned. There's a lot of glass-like stone and fragments of very superheated silica that shows very distinct evidence of nuclear activity. That definitely suggests that there was some nuclear activity on planet Earth. I think the whole nuclear thing is possibly misunderstood at the same time, because on the one hand, we see they used energy, sources of energy that were based on sound and vibrational frequency. And on the other hand, we have nuclear devices. And I'm not quite sure how the two link at this stage. There's a bit of a gap and a mismatch at the moment. You know, if you're going to use sound frequency and knowledge of the structure of matter, then why use nuclear devices when they are so destructive, not just to the people you're trying to destroy, but to yourself as well?
Sure. I don't know if you know David Hatcher Childress, a guest on Coast to Coast, and he truly believes in the ancient atomic warfare theory and believes that there's been an archaeological cover-up, as he says.
So yeah, I know David's work, and it's really fantastic. I'm a big fan of his work, and I agree with you. There's overwhelming evidence of, based on what he's discovered and many other people have written about, and there's overwhelming evidence that there was nuclear activity in ancient times. I'm just confused as to which group would have used nuclear weapons while the other group had the knowledge of vibrational frequency and energy and could have used something like a giant death ray, okay? And you don't have to go to the trouble of developing a nuclear device when you've got a giant death ray. You know, why pollute your planet and your atmosphere with nuclear explosions if you can just use a death ray, which is a lot less harmful to the surrounding areas?
Let's go to Albuquerque. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no, that's just really my take on it. I'm a bit confused as to maybe there were different groups of beings. And in fact, the latest information I've got is that the shapeshifters or the lizard people, the reptilians who came to planet Earth from Draco, the constellation Draco, there's a lot of talk and seeming evidence of that. It seems that the reptilians went to war with Anunnaki. And I believe that Anunnaki are not the same as the reptilians. And I think a lot of people, you know, throw them into the same pot. I believe Anunnaki are a completely different group of beings from the reptilians. Anunnaki seem to be coming to us from the Sirius star system and the Orion's Belt star system, which at one stage were the same star system. And then we get the arrival of the reptilians, who really caused havoc on planet Earth. And I believe that the reptilians actually are behind the control on planet Earth today and are probably the driving force and the dark, sinister side behind the Illuminati.
All right, now we go to St. Paul, Minnesota, east of the Rockies. Go ahead, William, you're up.
Hello, gentlemen. Consider this. There seem to be some indications that the Anunnaki never completely left and that there may be a presence that has been on Earth, and they've been manipulating us genetically and otherwise and monitoring us ever since the fall of their civilization in Zimbabwe. For an example, there used to be over 100, something like 15 different species of man 100,000 years ago, of which we, in all our forms today, are the sole remainder. Also, they could have figured in some of these contacts with the likes of George Adamski and Howard Menger during the 50s. And as for the nuclear thing, there is a 300-mile-wide dip in the ocean, in the Indian Ocean, and along the shorelines of India. The sands are heavily laced with the element thorium. So that could have had something to do with the ancient wars and possibly even the sinking of Lemuria.
Well, you know, you were talking about Atlantis before the break, David. I mean, Michael. And do you want to get into that now, or should we wait until after the break?
Yeah, just briefly. I mean, I would agree with most of what your caller said. The different species on planet Earth, definitely there have been a lot. I believe that the original species was only one, the created slave species. There's one species. And after that, when the gods, you know, the sons of the gods or the daughters of man, they came down and started shagging them, and that's where the trouble started.
Indeed. Okay, thanks, William. Appreciate your call. Let's go to you, Chase, in Dayton, Ohio. Go ahead.
Yes. Hey, George and Michael. How are you guys doing?
Chase. Good.
I got a question about the Egyptian pyramids, but, Michael, I believe you answered it before I even got on the air about the vibrational frequencies.
Yeah.
I think I now believe that the Egyptians used that to set up the pyramids, and I just want to know what you think about that.
All right.
Yeah. Absolutely. There's a wonderful five-episode documentary on Egypt and the pyramids, and I, for the life of me, now forget the producer's name, and it's fantastic. I think it's called the it escapes me now. But in there, these very smart geologists from the United States and archaeologists go, and they show you very distinctly the 22 pyramids that surround the Giza Plateau. They show you that the internal structures of the Great Pyramid are actually a resonant device to generate energy. And I've got some beautiful photographs of that actually captured the electromagnetic radiation and the frequency emitted from the Great Pyramid even today. So as a device, it still seems to emit high levels of electromagnetic radiation and frequency. So I believe the Great Pyramid was built very much like these early energy-generating devices here in South Africa, as an energy device for planet Earth.
All right, Michael, you stay with us. We're going to come right back with final phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. Here we go. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with Michael Tellinger. Michael, as we continue talking about this incredible discovery here, when Johann Hein found what you now call Adam's calendar, was he a believer in the Anunnaki story as well?
Yeah, fortunately, Johann was. Johann is an incredibly well-read and a broad-minded individual. And it was for that reason that he came to my talk on Slave Species of God. Johann actually thought I was an American author. He didn't even know I was a South African. He thought I was an American author visiting South Africa, and he thought, well, let me go and hear what this guy has to say. When he found out I was a fellow South African, he then shared all his information with me, and we started this incredible journey of discovery. And it really has been, it's just going faster and faster. It's incredible, you know.
Okay, back to the phones we go. Scott, first-time caller, Vancouver, Washington. You're on Coast to Coast,
Scotty.
Doing? Good.
Good show tonight.
Thanks.
Just a quick question. Why is there so much conflicting information about the arrival of Nibiru?
I guess because the information we have comes from the translations, and I suppose most of the vocal translations about the Nibiru comes from Zachariah Sitchin. And so, you know, my calculation has been based on his work rather than anything else.
I heard that his calculation was 2060, but tonight you said it was 15 to 2,000 years from now.
Yeah, I'll tell you why. Because in his last book, he talks about the translations talking about the arrival of Nibiru around 570 BC, somewhere around there.
Okay.
So if Nibiru was around 570 BC, then you know you can do the calculations yourself. And the thing is that you know, remember that Nibiru speeds up when it comes in. When it comes close to the sun, it would speed up just like a comet. So it's like a slingshot, right? So it comes close to the sun, it speeds up, and then it goes around the sun and gets flung out into space again. So it probably moves around the sun a lot quicker. It takes a shorter period of time to go around the sun than it does to move in deep space, if that makes sense.
All right, next up we go to Seabrook, Texas. Heather on the wild card line. Hello, Heather.
Hi. Yes, I had a question about the correlation of these stone structures around the world and the location of objects in space, and if you think they'll work simultaneously, and if they'll be activated by humans or visitors.
I missed the first part of your question, Heather. If there's a correlation between the stone circles and objects in space.
Yeah, there's the mysterious stone structures around the world. I guess that would include like Stonehenge as well.
Yes.
You mean like correlation like Orion's Belt and things like that?
Yeah, well, they work simultaneously, and are they correlated to an object or objects in space?
Well, personally, we haven't found any obvious correlations to anything in space at this stage. As you can imagine, that is a huge job and would require a team of experts and astronomers and archaeoastronomers and sophisticated technology to do that. At this stage, we really are just doing the initial groundwork, and we're only now ready to launch into the deep end of this research and this discovery. There's so much research we need to do and so many scientific experiments we need to do. But the only links we've made at this stage is to Polaris, the star Polaris, also Draco. There's a link to Draco, and there's a link to Orion's Belt. And that becomes very interesting. Because there are some places at Adam's calendar that link to the pole star, very distinctly linked to the pole star. And incidentally, this ancient site, which I now believe is 285,000 years old, Adam's calendar, its significance and its sacredness has continued in recent African culture. Because the amazing Credo Mutwa, whose work has been used by many people around the world, including myself, and we actually need to do a lot to help Credo because he's really, really down and out. But that's another story. If you want to help, please go to my website and there's a link to help Credo. Credo Mutwa was initiated as a shaman and a sangoma at Adam's calendar in 1937. And it was already a sacred site then among African culture. And it was, Credo tells me that it is among the two most sacred sites on planet Earth. He calls it where heaven mated with Mother Earth. And at first I didn't understand that until I figured out that is where they inserted the fertilized egg into those first seven Anunnaki females. That's what he meant by where heaven mated with Mother Earth. And I saw Credo a few weeks ago, and I asked him that question specifically. Is that what you meant? And he said, yes, that is what I meant.
Michael, is there any record of the propulsion system that they had?
No, not at this stage. But no, nothing. You know what we have discovered, though, George, is on this incredible giant slab, these glaciated slabs of andesite, which is the same as diorite. It's that very dark, very hard black rock. Many of the Egyptian statues are carved out of that same diorite stone, very, very hard. And incidentally, when you look at the Egyptian statues that are 5,000 years old, they are still as shiny today as the day they were made. It just shows you how long it takes for that rock to erode. And then when you come and look at the erosion on these incredible carvings and petroglyphs, there are thousands of them that are photographed on these slabs outside Kimberley in South Africa. That's where we incidentally found the carved ankh as well. There we find some very interesting and very, what we can't figure out, carvings into this very hard rock. that could be seen as rockets or jet propulsions or propulsion systems or energy propulsion systems and items like that. They definitely could be seen like that.
Okay, let's go to Cleveland, Ohio. Cody's with us now. Hi, Cody. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was wondering if you had heard about the giant comet, which was, I believe, twice the size of Jupiter, which came by our solar system in February of 2003, I believe,
yeah,
that some have speculated could have been this thing, Nibiru, which actually was repelled by a giant solar flare from the sun.
That was Comet Neat, by the way, NEAT.
Yes.
Comet Neat.
Went right by the sun.
If
Nibiru's got to be a planet if the Anunnaki came from there, right?
Yeah, correct. Yeah, it won't be a comet. I know about that from the work of Nassim Haramein, who you probably know about.
He's been on a couple times. He's a great guy.
Yeah, phenomenal researcher and physicist. And I found out about that comet. But there were apparently two comets that actually came through in short succession, that came around the sun into our solar system and then very quickly vanished. Now, according to Nassim Haramein, those comets or those objects were so large that they should have disturbed the gravitational pull, gravitational orbits of all the planets in the solar system, and yet they didn't.
If Nibiru is on this 3,600-year elliptical orbit, which means it gets far away from the sun, and if they're in our solar system, I wonder what they're using as a heat source. Is that what they needed the gold for, to protect its atmosphere? I mean, we need the sun, for example, we're not going to make it. If you go 3,600 years away, basically, the sun's going to look like a little dot. I wonder how that planet can survive.
Yeah, the Anunnaki and the Sumerian tablets talk about the planet having an internal heat system. Remember that some planets radiate heat and some don't.
Right.
In fact, most planets should radiate heat, but some don't, and that's probably an anomaly in itself. But they talk about Nibiru as being a radiating planet. So it radiated its own heat, and it had its own energy source. And that's why I guess they understood the flow of energy from the planet itself. And that's why they started using that kind of energy device when they arrived on this planet. Because it was just automatic to them, you know. It was an obvious thing to do. And the shield that they needed to create to protect their planet was really a shield in the upper atmosphere to protect them from cosmic rays, you know, cosmic rays, X-rays, ultraviolet rays, and all those things that destroy life on planet Earth. If we didn't have our ozone, we wouldn't be able to live here. So I guess they had similar problems there, but the heat they would have gotten from their planet itself.
Absolutely. Let's go to Temecula. Gilda, you're up with us. Hi, Gilda.
Hi there, George. I won't start off with a lot of questions, so I don't really know how to put it, but I discovered something when I was a very young girl, and I thought it was so odd and strange. I thought something was psychologically wrong with me, so I bothered not to talk to anybody about it. Something had been eaten away at me, and I didn't really think it was normal. And one of the things that I discovered was, And when I started to get a little bit older in my 20s, I had friends who were really interested in things of unknown. And I had all of a sudden put them in a trance. How I did it, I don't know. I didn't even know what I was doing. And then they started asking me questions. And it's like I tuned myself out and became like a radio receiver. And all of a sudden, they started asking me questions, and then I started like speaking like something else, like a computer would speak.
Like a different tongue?
Yeah, it wasn't a different tongue, but man, it was like a computer.
like you know how computers talk now? And I'm embarrassed to tell you this because it's crazy. And they were just staring at me like, "If what is going on?" These like there were four of us, and I thought, and then I didn't want to say too much. I didn't want to scare them away because I was obviously I was aware of what I was saying, but I don't know where these words came from. I was actually they were asking me questions like how to get to the moon. How to travel to different places in space.
Could this be channeling, Michael?
Well, it sounds to me like that. It's, you know, there's so much we don't yet understand about higher energy forms and how they interact with us as physical, you know, mortal humans. And that certainly sounds like it was, you know, your body was invaded by another high energy or some sort of other energy that knows how to do that and just used your body to communicate with the people around you. It happens all the time, and I don't think, you know, you should be too concerned about it. Maybe just think about it and try and figure out what it was and maybe try and do it again and understand it better. It could be a very, very powerful communication tool to use to get higher knowledge and information.
Okay, final one or two more callers here. We go to Mort in California. Go ahead, Mort. You're up.
Hey, George. Hey, Michael. Great show.
Thanks.
You very much. I had a question and kind of a comment. One of your callers said something about the Indian Ocean having a giant crater in it. Now, I was wondering, do we know where the moon and the Earth collided, and could that possibly be it?
Yo, you're bringing up the moon. The moon is such an anomalous celestial body. I think the more I study the moon, the less I realize I know. I'm sure George will agree with me on that.
But, I don't mean to throw a curveball at you. I just kind of thought, wow, that's a really cool question. I wonder if anybody has the answer to that.
Yeah, I'll tell you what it is. First of all, I don't think that the moon and the Earth have anything to do with each other. I don't think that the moon comes from the Earth. I don't believe the moon and the Earth ever collided. I believe that I now believe that the moon was brought into its position from another place. It could have originally been a moon from another planet, or it could have been a giant UFO that's made to look like a moon. But it's certainly a workstation right now. We now know that there's a lot of activity on the moon. That it's probably the base station where a lot of ETs are observing us and observing what's going on this planet. It's almost like watching a lab, this laboratory experiment in a way, I suppose. But the moon is a very strange. It's probably quite hollow based on many findings found, you know, even by NASA, what they refer to, that the moon rings like a bell and things like that, and anomalous activities on the moon and giant structures that have been reported by insiders and so forth. So I personally don't believe that the moon and the Earth have ever been connected.
Next up, we go to Mark in Hollywood. Grab you real quick, Mark. Go ahead.
Yeah. When you were speaking of – hi, George, and good evening.
Hi, Mark.
I was hearing about the death ray you were talking about, and there was a book that a friend of mine had. It was a very rare book about Nikola Tesla. And this book described this thing, this death ray, and it said that it was you supposedly, I mean, Tesla, I mean, this, if I was reading this caption right, when they were showing a diagram of what this thing looked like and what it could do, that it was a defense against aliens. Apparently, this man believed that there were, that alien races existed and they were, malevolent. And I think this is what his rediscovery of it was. And then, of course, the military, after he died, of course, you know, grabbed everything. And I'm wondering if they're not, if the Air Force or the Department of Defense is not trying to do that for, you know, maybe such a possible purpose. And the only other comment I want to make, and then I'll lead off because I know the time is short, I believe that this thing concerned the flood, I believe that was the Lord angry at these aliens for the way that his creation was used.
What do you think of that theory, Michael, as we wrap things up?
Yeah, look, let's deal with Tesla first.
That'll be all we'll have time for. Go ahead.
Yeah. Tesla's death ray is probably used by the Black Ops projects extensively. I think HARP is probably an extension thereof or a more modern version of that, and we know how destructive and dangerous HARP is. It's probably used against ETs, et cetera, as well. We've seen that in a lot of beautiful footage from NASA videos and so forth. We see these rays that come from planet Earth that just straight into deep space.
Truly remarkable. Michael, I want to thank you for being on the program. Website's all linked up at coasttocoastam.com. For Dave Bujenski, Dan Galante, Miranda Marino, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Ross Mitchell, George Nappy, and Punnett and Art Bell, who will be filling in for me on Friday, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.